Welcome to The Commercial Disco, a voyage of commercial discovery. This episode is proudly brought to you by CSIRO, Australia's National Science Agency and Innovation Catalyst. Explore the commercialization of great ideas across deep tech and science. Immerse yourself in conversations with the ambitious minds shaping Australia's unique innovation landscape. Discover their insights into what's needed to bring these remarkable ideas to life.
Hello, I'm James Riley, Editorial Director at InnovationAus.com. Welcome to The Commercial Disco, produced in partnership with the National Science Agency, CSIRO. Today I'm talking to Piers Grove, who wears a number of hats, but for the purpose of introduction, I'll say he's the co-founder and chair of Energy Lab. Welcome, Piers.
Thanks, James. Pleasure to join you.
Okay, I will go through some of these things. So Energy Lab is a kind of an accelerator, if I got that right, an accelerator in the energy transition space. You're also a co-founder at Boomerang Labs, which focuses on circular economy, and also a co-founder partner at Impact Ventures. So very heavily stacked in that startup innovation space.
Absolutely. It's been a recent adventure. I started Boomerang and Energy Lab about 7 or 8 years ago, and it's been new space for me, but I've thoroughly enjoyed getting into the startup ecosystem.
Okay, well, let me talk through some of your other past roles, and this is what I think is interesting in publishing. So you're a publisher for 7 years of the Batuta Advocate, very popular service, publisher and director at the Daily Oz, which has broken new ground in digital publishing or news, and also a publisher at Junkie Media, and also 6 years at the Australian Republican Movement, including a long time as deputy chair. So as I said, you've worn a lot of hats. So why don't we start with this? What is publishing, which is a tricky industry to be in, and the innovation space, where are the parallels between those two areas that got you excited?
I'm drawn toward new ideas and trying to tackle problems that exist, which is, you know, where things like the Republic movement fit in. Yes, publishing is a challenging industry, but at its core, I believe that the Australian public want and deserve access to good content and information. And while it's a journey to try and find our new footing, the underlying role of good media in Australia is undeniable. So, yes, it's going through a transition, but I believe that through persistence, we will land at a new place and a new business model that is sustainable, and the underlying service to society is what will ensure our relevance.
All right, I'm going to stay on publishing for just a moment because the news bargaining code has come up again in the news simply because Meta said they won't sign a renewal of their current arrangement. The mainstream media organisations are crying foul. They say it's going to strip a bunch of money, you know, off their books. As someone who's kind of been into digital native, digital first publishing from the get-go and doing some really interesting stuff, what do you make of that argument?
Look, it doesn't resonate with me. I appreciate that Nine and News are legacy businesses in many ways, and they're constantly fighting sinking circulation and sinking ad revenue alongside that. They're public companies. They've got shareholders to respond to. It would make sense for the leadership of those legacy organizations to look at where they could extract new revenue from. For digital first publishers or more new publishers, when we built Batuta Advocate and the Daily Oz, there's a bit of a Faustian pact with the social media networks. And that is essentially, I will deliver good quality, engaging content on your platforms and ideally thereby get their audiences to spend longer on those platforms. In return, I get to connect to a bigger audience at a very, very low, low cost. As a publisher, I have never put money to boost content. And yeah, I get an audience that way. And then once I have that audience, I can drive them back to my website. I can learn about them. I can promote to them. But it actually serves very effectively as a means of making my audience a community who can engage not only with my content, but with each other. So to me, the idea that they need to pay me to produce that content has never been part of my business model. The idea that then comes from them paying, and of course, if they want to drop $1 million into my bank account each year, I'm all for it. But you're going to have to figure out how to do that in a fair and equitable way, because last time around, a couple of years ago, when we were in this situation, sure, News and Nine got their share, but so many smaller publishers simply didn't. So Meta and Google were funding the big guys to bring on more resources, and the little guys got nothing. So to me, it's not a functional way of going about it. Perhaps the money needs to go into a central pot, and then the industry themselves can divvy it up. But, you know, picking winners and crowning them and leaving other smaller publishers without the ability to get into the game, it's not good for the industry.
Yeah, it's been a strange one for small publishers. I think niche publishers also, we would say this, we don't obviously get any money returned to us through those news bargaining codes. But also we have a very targeted, select, high-value audience, and I don't think that's necessarily rewarded by programs like that. So let's move on. I will ask one question, though. If Meta were to walk away from news, it's saying like news doesn't play a big part of its engagement, do you see that in itself, like if it's kind of de-ranking news as a feature on their platform, do you see that as having a potentially terrible impact on some of the smaller publishers that rely on it?
Oh, it's an existential threat for some of them. Look, I'm incredibly proud of what the guys at the Daily Oz have done. But their primary audience is on Instagram. The business was designed to take news to where the young, predominantly female audience were. And it was done intentionally on Instagram. If Instagram turned the Daily Oz off, that is an existential threat to that. And in fairness to all those particularly young women who are getting their news there, it's going to fall into a black hole. Absolute credit to the team at the Daily Oz, because they are working night and day to transition people to the podcast and to their newsletters. But that is a higher level of engagement from the audience than just that person who is scrolling through on Instagram who finds out about the Sam Kerr London incident or something that's in the news that they might otherwise completely miss. So yeah, I think it's a very, very scary prospect, not just for the publishers, but for their audiences.
Yeah. Well, in publishing, we'll be talking about platforms from, you know, for as far as the eye can see, I think, on a whole bunch of different levels. Let's move on to the other side of the work that you're doing, which is in that accelerator energy space. So Boomerang Labs and Energy Labs. Let's start there. So Energy Lab is looking at energy transition.
Yep.
And Boomerang Circular Economy. Just talk us through the business model of each of those and what's exciting. What are you looking at?
Look, I was sort of the origin story for Energy Lab. It was I was looking to start a new business in the energy space. During this energy transition, we've got a much clearer sense of the destination than we do of the journey to get there. You know, we can look forward 20, 30 years and we know we're going to be overwhelmingly powered by renewables. The nature and two-way infrastructure of how we generate and share energy is going to change. We are electrifying and pulling the fossil fuels out and embracing storage and batteries. So that's where we're going. But the process from where we're at to getting there is a huge challenge. And a huge challenge is what should draw a good entrepreneur to look into the space. But it's a very, very difficult space to innovate in. And so it didn't take me very long to realize that rather than try to build my own company, me and one of my co-founders, Nick Lake, decided that we'd actually better off building some infrastructure that all of the energy startups could share. And those challenges are heavily, heavily regulated area. You can't just knock up an MVP and throw it against the wall. You are playing with very dangerous and critical infrastructure. The second is it's very difficult to get directly to an end customer. You usually have to go through industry. Even if your goal in life is to wipe AGL off the face of the planet, you're probably going to have to start with a partnership with them to get to a customer. And there's a lot of hardware in there. And hardware, regulation, intermediated markets are not the friends of venture capital. And we really felt that we needed a specific set of support and partnerships to promote clean energy innovation in Australia. So that's where Energy Lab came from. It's been set up and operating as a not-for-profit. We've just recently got our DGR status, and we are largely funded by corporate partners and government programs. Boomerang Labs and our focus on circular economy came about because it has a fair bit in common in that there's a lot of hardware in there, if nothing else. And so we started seeing circular economy and zero waste startups rocking up to Energy Labs' doors. And while we could support them in many ways, they did require a different set of mentors, a different set of partnerships with industry, and just a different cohort that could relate to each other around their industry in the same way that the clean energy people could within Energy Lab. So Boomerang really came up as a little cousin of Energy Lab and is a few years behind and is really starting to hit its straps now. It's also worth noting that we wound up expanding Energy Lab up into Cambodia and quite recently opened in Laos and doing really important work up there in Southeast Asia as well. So the thing has grown and beyond our initial expectations, and it's something I think we're all proud of.
So just talk me through Energy Lab. You talk about the common infrastructure that startups can come in and use. Are you literally talking about physical spaces and hardware, or are you talking about that knowledge base of interacting with regulatory environments and corporates?
Yeah, it's the word labs has haunted us in that it does imply that there's a set of labs with people in white coats. There is not. It's really about access to mentors, the precise knowledge that you need to understand how the substation network operates in regional Australia ain't available on Wikipedia. So you need a really good group of experts that you can draw on, and you need to be able to talk to the poles and wires, the generators, the retailers to get to customers in many situations. And it's worth noting that the primary quality of energy companies that we value above all else is reliability. So these companies are inherently conservative. They're not geared for innovation. So Energy Lab becomes the halfway house. It's the place where we've got small enough hands to handle fine startups, and that the large industry players can come in and feel that they're able to access innovation, but with guardrails, because we've got that expertise. We appreciate the quality of the founders, the depth of the IP, and the capital requirements and how it all fits. So there's almost this lovely pact between Energy Lab and government and industry, which is we ask industry to take seriously whatever we bring to them, and we promise not to bring them garbage. And that's sort of the two-way deal that has worked very, very well.
So I want to drill down into this. It's very interesting. Energy transition is obviously a very broad term. So I guess I want to ask, What kinds of startups, what kinds of industry partners? Are they all generators? Are they retailers? Or are you getting right down to supply of battery raw materials?
Probably not down to battery raw materials, but it is a very, very broad area. So, you know, we see a lot of startups trying to tackle energy efficiency. You know, when I was a kid, that was turn off the lights when you leave the room. That didn't really work. But now we've got very smart air conditioning systems and load balancing and prioritization technologies. So, I mean, that is in itself a huge area. We're seeing a lot around electric vehicles and the electrification of mobility and the infrastructure that comes with that. I know we're all terrified of range anxiety. So there's plenty of companies looking at how to attack that, from share plug networks to shopping centers. And these cars are going to become enormous assets to the energy grid over time. So it's not just replacing petrol stations with chargers. It's, well, what does Westfield do when they've got 2,000 electric cars parked in their shopping centres that all want a little bit of a charge, but perhaps they could also power the shopping centre from those cars when prices on the grid are very high? So how do we use all of these assets and orchestrate them to deliver really good outcomes? So energy innovation is a heck of a lot more than getting rid of coal and sticking solar panels in. It's about completely rethinking how we generate, use, and share our power. In terms of the big industry partners, they're trying to figure out how to transition, and they're not able to do and think of everything themselves. One of our startups, Allegro, Origin Energy, recently took a 5% position in them because they are going to be a central supplier of storage into their grid. And that is a strategic decision by Origin to work with an early stage company, which is far more nimble and responsive and innovative than Origin is capable of doing in-house. It's not a question of money, it's a question of capacity. We've got another one called InfraVision at the moment, who are able to install high power transmission cables much, much faster, much, much more safely at a lower cost than the traditional method of helicopters, which was actually quite dangerous. So we have got to double the amount of transmission around the planet as we are relocating where the generation happens. You're going to put a giant solar farm or wind farm offshore or in the middle of the desert, you've got to build really long, powerful, reliable infrastructure. So the innovation has to happen in so many different places, and it's the coordination of all these things that make for the new energy world that we're moving to. And that's the fun, getting these bits in there, getting them up and functional, and seeing already better outcomes. You know, people thought electric cars were going to kill the weekend. Anyone who owns an electric car knows that it actually enhances the weekend. It's a heck of a lot of fun. And, you know, they don't burst into flames. I find that one hilarious, given that everyone else is putting dinosaur juice that's highly flammable into a tank that rolls around in the bottom of the car. And people are worried about batteries bursting into flames. I know which one I personally prefer and which one the numbers support for safety, and it's the EVs.
Let me ask you, of the companies that you engage with, these young innovators, are they generally kind of coming out of universities, are they corporate entrepreneurs? When you're engaging with these entrepreneurs, are they jumping out of McKinsey to do something? Is there an archetype?
Look, there is to some degree. We do get 25-year-old sort of startup entrepreneurs who, you know, are inspired by the Silicon Valley VC model, but we tend to have more success with mid-career entrepreneurs. And you've identified two very good sources for finding founders. One is the professional consultants who have seen behind the curtain and have seen the genuine opportunities to innovate. And the other is people who have technical background, either from inside a university where they've been researching and developing new materials or new methods, or people who come out of the AGLs, the Origins, the Transgrids, where they've been there for 10, 15, 20 years, and they know that there's a better way of monitoring network performance remotely. And they can't necessarily get that up in-house, and so they take the brave leap to become a founder.
It's quite amazing, isn't it? Someone taking a decision like that is, well, it is brave, isn't it? You're jumping out of a definite comfort zone into literally a great unknown if you've always been with a larger organization.
Most certainly. And I have an immense amount of respect for many of the people who do this, because it's not an instant path to wealth. The average time for a clean tech company to exit is over 13 years. And it's a really long, slow slog, you know, and the energy industry is actually remarkably well paid overall. So it is a very brave step. But when you see something that needs to be fixed and you think you know how to fix it, there is thankfully a subset of our society who will walk through fire to get that done.
I mean, I know you can't generalize on these things, but what's the motivation for these people? Are they engineers who just can't bear the fact that something that needs fixing isn't getting fixed? Or is it a chasing rainbows or chasing dollars or social conscience around emissions?
Yeah, look, I think there's two of the main things, and you're right, you can't generalize perfectly, but two of the things are the itinerant engineer who needs to make things better. They've been working on a solar farm that could be 7% more effective if you were able to forecast the shadow of clouds overhead several hours in advance. You know, that would be a huge input into the ability to manage the energy network. So there's people who just want to fix stuff, and I think that's really tremendous. The other group is the values-driven. You know, there is, particularly in Gen Y and the millennials, a lot of very talented people, including one of my co-founders at Energy Lab, James Tilbury, and he and his wife are simply devoting their lives to trying to expedite action to turn around climate change. And it's a noble pursuit in life, and to be able to give those sorts of people some resources and support is very important. So that sort of generation are more looking at, where are the weaknesses? Where can we prop it up? How do we get people to embrace new generation, new transportations, new business models? And that is also more what we often see coming out of the consulting side. There's a tremendous, I wouldn't call it a startup anymore, but a new energy retailer called Amber Electric that came through our program, now with a significant investment from Commonwealth Bank, and they are giving tools to consumers to make their own choices about the power that they use by giving them access to the wholesale energy market, something that most retailers keep very well hidden from consumers. Amber see a way in which empowering consumers to make better choices around renewable energy simply supports that sector and moves us away from coal and gas a little bit faster. So purpose is also a big driver.
Okay, so you're obviously being up to your elbows in this energy transition stuff. I just wanted to ask you, the climate debates, the political debates around climate have been somewhat frustrating, I'm sure, provided a lot of material for the Batuta Advocate along the way. I want to ask you, where do you think we are at right now in terms of that kind of debate? And then what about nuclear?
Yeah, right. Well, the debate at this stage, to me, is nothing more than a political football. Sure, in Australia, we associate climate change and energy transition with the left. And yet, if I go over to the UK, people like Boris Johnson, who we would certainly associate with the populist right, were driving some of the most ambitious goals and schemes to facilitate a transition. I think the notion that we're still debating climate change is...
I think that's just...
Yeah, it's just not a debate. And I think it's really harmful that some on the right continue to use it as a weapon against the left. Some things are simply science. The question about nuclear is a really interesting one. It's like the last bastion for people who see renewable energy as a left political ideology. Why else would you advocate for a technology that is so expensive? We're looking at prices that are 4 to 5 times more expensive than solar or wind, even when they're coupled with storage and batteries. The other thing is, it's not as simple as just going out and banging up a nuclear generator. There's a whole industry that needs to be built, and that is a minimum 10-year roadmap. I have no doubt that nuclear has come so far from those cliches of Three Mile Island and Chernobyl that it is an overwhelmingly safe technology. In principle, I have no objection to it being deployed, but rationally, the timelines and the costs don't make sense. And the logical thing is to get behind renewables and stop fighting over it. We've been using renewables. Tasmania has been powered by hydro since the advent of electricity, a beautiful renewable source. It has never been politicized. You don't hear either side of politics saying hydro must go. But for some reason, we're having these conversations about other forms of renewable that are seen as politically charged when they're just good, cost-effective energy generators.
Yeah, I find that the nuclear one, this Peter Dutton has obviously brought this up in recent weeks. It's fascinating for no other reason than younger people seem more open to the idea of the discussion than older people. So just looking at it through a political lens, it's kind of fascinating.
Yeah, I understand the attraction of it. It's cool tech. It's just not the right tech at this point in history. If we were, frankly, having this conversation 20 years ago, I think it would have had a much, much more viable argument for it. You always just test the market. It's always a good test. Who out there right now in the private sector is putting up their hand to build a nuclear power station? I don't think that there is a single soul with an Excel spreadsheet and a CFO who is going to say, yeah, let's do it. Let's put our money into this. It's going to be paying off for the next 50 years. It just doesn't work.
Yeah, if there was a spreadsheet out there, it would have a giant hole in it that the government would be expected to fill, I assume.
And that's it. I mean, the energy sector has been privatized by choice of the government for quite some time. And the private sector is saying renewables, and it's doing that investment of its own accord. It's not, you know, yes, there's the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, which was there to provide affordable finance during the transition, but their role is actually, hopefully, phasing out as the commercial stand up all on their own.
Okay, so I'm going to race through a couple of things. I'm talking to Piers Grove. He's the co-founder and chair at Energy Lab, but also co-founder and executive director at Boomerang Labs. So circular economy, I mean, it's starting to get a lot of momentum in this country, but do you think it's fair to say we're kind of late to this?
Yeah. I mean, this is like many things in Australia where I'm a Gen X guy. I remember when the yellow-lidded garbage bin turned up and we started separating our glass and paper, and the whole country had this sort of pat on the back. You guys are awesome. You're doing your recycling. And now, 30, 40 years later, we're still patting ourselves on the back for this huge achievement. And we've added a green bin, if you're lucky, to it. The concept of circularity in many people's minds, if they even know that concept, is recycling. It's leaving all your supply chains exactly as they are and just dealing with the garbage that comes off the end in a hopefully more sustainable way than shoving it in a hole and putting dirt on top of it. Like, seriously. So when we talk about circular economy, we really want to be talking about product design. We want to be designing the waste out of the products in the early stages. So to say that Australia is behind is an understatement, given that that very concept, even in many of our governments, is around recycling or reuse. We're not even thinking about the sector in the way that we should be. Waste needs to be designed out of our products.
So let me ask you this. I spent some time in Germany a couple of years ago and visited a Fraunhofer Institute that was just focused on materials, but materials in relation to circular economy issues. Now, do we have the industrial base in Australia or the complexity of industrial base to even kind of come to grips with what you're talking about, like product design through completion, through retirement, and then deconstruction?
Yes. In so many ways, we're actually much, much better set up to evolve our products than we are to evolve the way we deal with the waste. I mean, we are constantly let down. We only have to look at the soft plastics debacle that occurred in the last couple of years, where we all thought we were doing the right thing and then dropping our soft plastics off, only to find out that they're really just being stored in giant warehouses. You only have to go out to some of these recyclers, and there is an enormous backlog of PET and aluminium sitting there that we cannot process. Our systems were designed to offshore process in China, and China closed the door on that. And with respect, I think, understandably, you know, who wants to take everyone else's junk? And so Australia is not equipped to process all this stuff. The people at Coca-Cola would happily put every product that they make into recycled PET, but they cannot lay their hands on the feedstock. So let's look at the fact that the recycling process is so broken that we as a society are actually much, much better off going up to the design end, and consumers are on board for it. You may be familiar with a company called ZeroCo, who are a subscription for all your cleaning products, both personal and household. And they've managed to make the containers completely reusable, the sprays and the dispensers of all sorts. And then they just send you a tablet that dissolves in regular water to become spray and wipe or dishwashing detergent or clothing detergent. And that company has done tremendously well by designing out the waste, having a direct relationship with consumers, which is what we all like. We don't like the Woolies and Coles. No one's a huge fan of taking the 8-kilo packet of laundry detergent home when I can have a couple of tablets turn up in the post. So I think that's the better way to address it. And I think that's where Australia is better set out to do it. But education is key. We're seeing a lot of this stuff happening with younger generations. And that's not exclusive. There's certainly baby boomers who are innovating and getting on board with this stuff. But it's the younger guys who have the appreciation of how things could be different. And we need to make sure that that is understood by all consumers, because then companies will be commercially driven to make the change.
Okay, look, I'm going to finish on this question. And I asked the same thing of Energy Lab. So Boomerang Labs, who's coming through that program? What kinds of companies is there? Are there kind of trend lines around what we're good at in this country, or is it a mixed bag of circular economy focused?
It's a pretty big mix. I'll throw two or three quick examples at you. We've got a wonderful company called Bear Hug. If you've ever seen those pallets of products in warehouses, they're wrapped in literally 300 grams of Glad wrap to hold them in place. Bear wrap simply replaces that with a fabric wraparound. It's reusable 1,000 times as opposed to once. It's a massive cost saving. One very specific area that they can tackle: if Coles removed that wrapping from their pallets, they would save more plastic than removing every shopping bag from every one of their supermarkets. We have another one called Charapi, who, if you've ever seen those waste recycling bins in food courts, that stuff's not going to recycling. It's so infected that it's going straight to landfill, and we all know it. It's a facade. So they simply have a system where you have to scan the barcode of any product packaging before the bin opens and lets you put it in. So you've got a can of Coke, yep, no problem, in it goes. You've got a packet of chips, no, it will not open to that barcode. Mindful of time, I mean, that just gives you a couple there. You know, in America and Europe, there's more like 20 to 30 different lines of recyclable waste as opposed to our yellow bin, which we think is terrific. There's companies helping to recover that out of the construction industry, coming up with new materials that are more sustainable. There's so much going on in that sector. I would encourage people to come to Boomerang Labs website and have a look at the alumni and the different companies that are coming through our programs at the moment. I swear you will leave with one great idea you want to take into your life tomorrow.
All right, beautiful. Piers Grove, thanks so much for joining us on the Commercial Disco, and thanks for bringing your energy and intellect to the programs that you're running.
Thanks, James. It's been a pleasure to join you.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Commercial Disco podcast, proudly brought to you by CSIRO. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you heard us. For the latest on tech, innovation, and public policy, visit innovationoz.com. And stay connected with us on social media to ask questions or suggest future guests. Until next time, this is the Commercial Disco wishing you an inspired week ahead.